You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hey everyone, this is Nick. I'm a little hoarse because it's pollen season and I'm always fighting a cold or a sinus infection. It's how I roll, baby. Anyway, so this is the last episode of this season. It's going to be a disremembered episode, as you can see. There will be one new episode this summer that will be a crossover with Geekly Oddcast, and there should be several other, interesting things this summer we have planned. I have some crossovers and some guest spots, and we're going to do a Bond series in honor of all the news coming out about Bond 25, finally. But I wanted to thank you guys. This has been a great season. Season 5 is just about in the books, and there were some tech glitches near the end that caused our season to go into chaos. But next year, we've got some cool stuff already being planned, and I'm excited for it. So I appreciate your support. I appreciate everything you guys do for the channel and all the support you've given us over this last year. If you want, and I appreciate this when you do, keep reviewing us. Our numbers have been fluctuating a lot the last couple weeks, and I blame myself because I've been busy and not doing the social networking thing. But I would appreciate it if you can help us socially too. Letterboxd, Facebook, Twitter, reviewing on iTunes, all are good things to do. And they all come out to support us. Also, Cineprov will be doing a show on the first Thursday of every month, no matter what, rain or shine. And this time around, that Thursday is the 6th. They're doing Red Dawn, and I'm not in that show, but I will be in the audience with you enjoying it. And then what is July 4th may change, just because doing a show on July 4th in downtown Atlanta is insane when there's fireworks every 5 feet, and we wouldn't have any audience. But we will do a show in July. I will let you know how that turns out, because you'll still hear my voice every Thursday until next season when we go to an every other Thursday format. But that allows us to do more crazy stuff, and we're going to try to do some commentaries and some, talking about movies right as it comes out, and maybe a riff or two. So enjoy. And thanks.
You ever been curious about the real or fictional worlds?
In the beginning, there were laser kings and giant robots.
Those who created.
I'm going to feed you to this tentacle monster now. No.
Or what inspires.
And I remember being in my room with my brother, and we immediately, like within 5 seconds, he decided he was a DC fan and I decided I was a Marvel fan. And we were going through and sorting out all of the comics.
And you might enjoy Hubie Tigers, the only podcast show where we take life by the tail. Now available on Google Play, Stitcher, and iTunes, and of course your favorite podcasting network. This is Hubie Tigers.
Welcome to Disremembered, the stories behind your childhood. This is episode 5 now of the Disney Renaissance, and I'm once again joined by Nick and John. Say hi, guys.
Hey, buddy.
Hi.
Hello. I know it's been a while since we've sat down and recorded. Well, if you recall the last time, I was talking about how Katzenberg had suddenly left the company. Well, not suddenly, they owed him a lot of money and were refusing to pay. And Eisner was not sure who he would replace as his number two guy at Disney. Well, he had an idea for somebody named Michael Ovitz. Ovitz had been a high-powered Hollywood agent. He had defected from William Morris to form his own agency called CAA, and he did it with 4 other people whose names I couldn't be bothered to look up.
That's that extensive research that
I was going to say. Oh. The kind of thing I come to expect from people on my podcasting group.
He also helps make Sony's deal to buy an American studio, which has also been covered. John Peters running it in Hit and Run, if anybody remembers that book. He wanted to run the record division, but Sony balked at his asking salary. Ovitz had been friends with Michael Eisner at the time, and he was jealous of the amount of money Eisner was making. Eventually, though, he convinced him, and Eisner told other Disney executives that he intended to hire Ovitz as the new replacement for Katzenberg in 1995. When it was announced in the press, though, a lot of people thought that Ovitz seemed nervous about his new position, and there was a lot of confusion around it. Although he was nominally the number two man, he wasn't the COO, and he was reporting directly to Michael Eisner rather than the board.
I'm just going to throw this out there. I don't recognize the name, so I'm guessing this doesn't end well for
not
him.
Not real. Well, it does end well for him, but not necessarily for anybody else, and you'll see why in a second.
Do tell.
I also love looking through my notes because I use text-to-voice speak, and this guy's name shows up as, like, Ovitz, Overage, O. Pitts, I think. There's just so many spellings of this guy's name, and I hope my accent isn't that terrible. He didn't have an agenda at Disney, and it seemed like Eisner didn't really know what to do with Ovitz. Eisner, at this point, if you recall correctly, Katzenberg and Eisner had joined at about the same time at Disney and had worked together, so they knew each other and were considered equals. Eisner wanted a number two guy, but basically, based on my reading, his ego just wouldn't let him share the glory with anybody else.
That sounds like the one we've come to know and love. I don't know why this is a
surprise.
It's like
a particular personality who gets to run companies like this.
Yeah. Not mine, but...
Also, another big thing, Ovitz was not in charge of the animated films like Katzenberg had been. The new animation chief, Peter Schneider, continued reporting directly to Eisner and not Ovitz. One thing Ovitz...
So what did Ovitz want? Was he more of a feature film, like live-action guy, or
well, he had
what?
Been an aged... Well, that was part of the thing, is they never really knew what to do with him. Nominally, he'd be the president of the company and supposedly the number two guy. Basically, somebody that Eisner could lean on, but Eisner just really wouldn't give him any responsibilities.
That doesn't sound like a good idea.
So, is he trying to breed dissent at this point? Like, I'm trying to figure out what his end game is. You know, like, you're setting yourself up to be around with people who, I mean, for lack of a better term, have to do whatever you say, right? And they don't have equal weight to you. They're beneath you. It's a monarchy, right? That works if you're brilliant, but he's like, Spielberg could do that, and people would be like, oh, Mr. Spielberg. I don't get that feeling from Eisner, who seems like he had a few good ideas, and now he's running on steam, right?
I mean, that's pretty much it. If you'll recall in the last episode,
oh, good, we're done. That'd be great.
Sorry, everybody. As we're recording this, Nick's at home with a sick baby, which I'm sure is no fun.
Yeah, she's fine. My wife's taking care of her. Ooh, I got a copy of the Brony movie.
Ooh, there you go.
I'm sorry.
All right.
Anyway,
one thing Ovitz did try to do was to fix the situation and continuing problems that Disney had with Katzenberg. This meant doing things like approaching Katzenberg at future CEO Bob Iger's wedding. So, yeah. Imagine that. He's in the middle of wedding going, hey, so this is a happy day. You want to drop that massive lawsuit and forget about the money we owe you?
I also don't get the feeling that any of these people are particularly sober at any point. Like, this is not someone who's a principled, like, teetotaler, is it? Like, so he's coming up, he's, like, half drunk. He's like, hey, fuck you guys.
Open bar at the funeral? I'm there.
Yeah, right?
Well, speaking of funeral, one of the last times that Eisner and Katzenberg had actually spoken to each other was at Don Simpson's funeral, who had originally been a... Jerry Bruckheimer's producing partner, and they had all been partners at Paramount.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's odd. That's awkward.
It was very awkward. But Ovitz still felt that he could fix the situation. So after Ovitz approached Katzenberg, he managed to get a meeting set up, but then Eisner canceled that meeting.
Of course he did.
It got so bad that by 1996, Ovitz was openly writing memos about ways he could save his position at Disney. He also made a lot of business mistakes, so he was just not having a good tenure. He tried to...
So not only was he in a useless position, he wasn't very good at that useless position.
And he was second-guessed by Eisner at every single moment. For example, he tried to make a deal with TV producer Brad Grey to buy the rest of Grey's production company. Grey suggested a price, but then Eisner came in and tried to have that price lowered. Oh. And it ended up ruining the relationship between Grey and Ovitz. Ovitz also brought in Martin Scorsese to make films for Disney.
That seems like a bad fit.
Well, the live-action, more adult divisions, like at Miramax and stuff.
I mean, the Touchstone. Yeah, right. Right, like...
Yeah, okay.
I mean, like, and they did that with Tarantino, but even still, Tarantino has almost a whimsy with his bloodshed. I don't know, whatever. I like Scorsese, but it just doesn't seem very Disney.
I kind of want to see Scorsese do a Mickey Mouse short. Ha ha! You talking to me? You talking
you know
to me?
Credit where credit's due. Hugo was beautiful.
Mm, sure was.
Oh. Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
that, that would qualify as, I mean, it's not quite how Disney does animation, but it is an animated movie that's cute. But that's where I'm going to leave it. I will draw it there.
Haha. Do you think I'm funny? Am I like a clown? Do I amuse you? Haha. Okay.
Yo, this fucker doesn't shut up, does he?
Well, anyway, the first movie that Scorsese directed as part of that deal was the movie Kundun. Does anybody remember that?
No, but you got really close to saying a profanity, I think.
Kundun?
K-U-N-D-U-N. It's about the Dalai Lama, I believe.
I believe you could say whatever you want and we would believe you.
I'm guessing, because the three of us are generally pretty well-versed in movies... If we haven't heard of it, it did not do very well.
Well, it ended up causing problems with the Chinese government because...
No, shit.
Really? Dude said.
Well, Eisner literally had to hire Henry Kissinger to negotiate with the Chinese government so the Chinese government wouldn't ban future Disney movies.
We promise the Avengers will destroy at least 3 Chinese properties in their next picture. How about that?
Wouldn't you have just loved to be a fly on the wall for that conversation?
I mean, Henry Kissinger is not exactly... Well, I mean, I was going to say he's not exactly interesting, but he is a sex pot somehow, so I don't know how any of this works.
Wait,
together.
What?
He
used to hook up with Jill St. John, the Bond girl, back in the 60s and 70s.
No. Kissinger?
Okay, I will send it to the chat window. Give me 1 second. I have a picture.
Okay.
Oh, I don't want a picture.
No, they're in a bar. It's okay. He's wearing pants. Anyway, go on.
All right. Due to all these mistakes, by December 1996, Eisner and Ovitz agreed that Ovitz would have to leave the company. Originally, it would not be announced until after Christmas, but the news leaked and was out by December 14th. Ovitz had only been at the company for 14 months.
Oh, shit.
He makes Scaramucci look like... Yeah,
the champion.
What's going on?
Uh oh.
Oh. Huh.
Yeah.
He's got that 50s look going on, I guess.
Well, I mean, at the time, he's not like he's an old guy. Now, of course, even that was for political reasons, of course, because as though he was a party animal and a drinker. This is him meeting Lenya Brezhnev. And of course, you brought Jill St. John along, and here he is still checking out her.
Have you ever seen?
There you go.
Have you ever seen such a glorious buttocks?
She is built like the Berlin Wall,
Mr. Ambassador.
All right. So, what happened after Ovitz?
One more. You might be the premier of this Soviet Union, but she has a premier ass.
All right.
I'm done. That's all I got.
Somehow I'm still alive and still checking out that sweet ass.
All right. I can't wait to see how the audio on that looks. Once Ovitz was out the door, a lot of controversy ensued over his exit package. He was walking away with at least $90 million, or potentially more.
Wow. Is that stock? Is that pay?
The mixture what is of that? Both. It was his total compensation package for that time, and based on the contract he'd signed, once he left the company, that was basically his exit package.
Wow. Golden parachute.
And again, after 14 months and a bunch of bad deals and being second-guessed by Eisner.
I can do that. Give me a go.
I know. Right? Tell me about it.
I will gloriously fail for you, sir.
I'm already doing it right now.
All right.
Shareholders were not happy about this deal. Some suggest... Some suggested that Eisner should pay the money out of his own pocket.
And that went over well.
During the shareholders meeting in 1997, Eisner said that hiring Ovitz had been a mistake that won't happen again. It didn't help him too much. What was more controversial also is the contract that Eisner signed for another 10 years that was worth a lot of money. Let me see. Ah, here we go. He signed a deal to remain Disney chairman for another 10 years in 1997. His compensation was estimated to be somewhere between $195 million and $771 million.
I mean, this is not an economics show, otherwise Kai Ryssdal would just unsubscribe immediately. But, like, I don't know how much... Okay, so you could argue, we've talked kind of jokingly about how terrible sometimes the money is figured out on these movies, right? Like, we kind of reference the fact that people who write these movies never get paid because they claim movies like Forrest Gump or Apollo 13 never turn a profit.
Right.
Right? So just looking at other assets, like merchandising now for Star Wars, like how much the parks take in. How much, like, he would be making money off Disney for decades after he stops being relevant, no matter how successful he is, making nearly $1 billion? That's insane.
Well,
that's what you get when you're head of the biggest entertainment company in the world.
But remember, this is before it was. Like, at this point, it was successful. Now you could make that argument when they've bought up 20th Century Fox and they've bought up everything. I don't know if back then they were – I mean, they were clearly in good shape. Let's not think
they
Disney's in bad shape.
They were in good shape, but this is kind of where they had just the peak had – they'd reached the summit and they were going back downhill.
Right. Yeah, if I were an investor, I'd be pissed.
When a vote was taken at the same shareholder meeting to re-elect the board members, 12% of the shareholders voted against it. That was seen as a significant protest.
Wow.
Eisner, for his part, said that his pay was tied to the company's performance. He and Frank Wells had agreed from the start that their salaries would be lower than other CEOs would get, and their rewards would be tied to Disney's stock.
That's fair.
Well, that's why, though, his compensation was worth so much, is because he received, like, 8 million shares in Disney stock. So it made sense, but it only would work as long as Eisner was raking in the hits, and that was not what was happening at the time. Let's get into some of the movies that Disney was releasing, starting with what's still going on, their live-action remakes of their past hits. Starting with, and I'm sure you all remember this, the live-action 101 Dalmatians with Glenn Close in it.
I went on a date in sixth grade for that movie.
It wasn't too bad.
It was cute. I mean, that's all I remember. I think my mom was in the background.
He was one of the bad guys, didn't it?
Yes, yes, he was. Yes.
Who was the other guy? It wasn't Fry,
no,
was
it?
No, it
wasn't. That would have been so Wouldn't much that be great? Better.
Wasn't he a bad guy in something? Was he like in like the third Home Alone
I'm
movie?
I'm pretty sure, actually, now that I think about it, and feel free to correct me if right? I'm wrong, the other bad guy was the guy that played Ron Weasley's dad. Does that sound right?
Okay. I'm trying to pull it up subtly here, but I'm no good. Mark Williams. So, yes, it was.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Wow. Well, that. So yeah, deep cut there. That film actually ended up grossing $500 million worldwide.
Yeah, they won't learn a lesson like that.
Oh. Yeah, oh, really. And I did find out this piece of trivia. The movie was produced and written by none other than John Hughes.
Of course it
and
was.
And this is actually, according to the Tribune, the movie that earned Hughes the most money because he got some of the merchandising revenue.
Really?
Smart man.
So they tried to do it again with a remake of The Absent-Minded Professor in 1990.
With Eddie Murphy.
No, with Robin Williams, and they renamed it Flubber.
Oh, yes! Yeah. I was thinking of Dr. Doolittle, wasn't I?
I think you were thinking of The Nutty Professor.
Yes, I was.
Yeah,
right, I'm
both
sorry.
Of which. Man, I don't remember much about Flubber. I remember not being too impressed by it.
Well, it still made a profit. It grossed $178 million worldwide, but it's got a 23% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
That's about right for this era.
Yeah.
It was also followed up by That Darn Cat, which nobody remembers.
I remember the original.
They remade it in the 90s. It's got 13% on Rotten Tomatoes and only grossed $20 million domestically.
Ew. I mean, the original wasn't very good. It was, if I remember right, we kind of covered that era in the early Disney era. Because I remember watching it on the Disney Channel when they actually showed movies. And it was like a... Was it black and white? Was that what it was?
It sounds right.
I think it was in color, I think.
It was that and, like, the cat from outer space. The thing where the boy turns into a dog.
I don't know.
I don't remember. They're all stupid movies. And I'm sure the remakes weren't very good either. Wait, That Darn Cat had Christina Ricci in
I'll take your word for it. I never saw it. I just remember in elementary school in the hall, somebody had hung up a poster on it on, like, the public board where... they'd hang the lunch menu and everything. That's all I remember about that movie.
Well, the original That Darn Cat had Haley Mills in it.
Ah, very well then.
And the new one had Christina Ricci and Dougie Doug. Oh, I do remember
Dougie
this movie.
Doug?
It was atrocious.
Doug the rapper?
Doug. Yes, indeed.
Oh, God. Now I have to see this movie.
Oh, please don't.
The final live-action remake that Disney produced around this time was The Parent Trap, which actually did pretty well.
With Lindsay Lohan?
That was her first big thing.
Cute Lindsay Lohan, before the drugs.
Yeah, before a lot of disaster.
It still has an 86% on Rotten Tomatoes, and it only grossed about $84 million, but it was made for only $15. So, you know, well done.
Yeah, really. Well, they already had the script, so they didn't need to do anything. They didn't have to worry about twins or anything.
No, technology's better now.
Yep. Although, I don't think they had to worry about twins in the first place, did they? Because, again, that was Haley Mills
in
the original.
Same thing, they did the same thing that they did in the original. It was just one actress, and they were just using a bunch of trick photography.
Yeah. I still think it would have been easier just to get twins.
Probably. Well, then they couldn't afford Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen for $15 million at the time, let's be honest.
What about T.N. Tamara Mari or whatever their names were?
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
There I am plugging all the holes in your story, Daniel.
Well, either way, those films, especially with some of the lower grosses and lower critical acclaim, was kind of a step away from when, you know, Disney was getting Best Picture Oscar nominations. Also, there were some problems that Disney was having business-wise. First off, in 1997, this isn't really a business problem, just something I found interesting. Captain EO closed at Disney.
That's funny.
This was about 4 years after Michael Jackson's legal issues, let's say. Well, his first round of legal issues. Also, at this time, Disney opened Animal Kingdom in 1998, but so many animals died at the park that the federal government launched an investigation into their practices.
That's horrible.
That I didn't know. I didn't, like, I knew it had done badly. That's really funny that that's how badly it did.
What was it, just malnourishment or poor care or what?
It might have been bad luck. I mean, animals die, but, like, that's
really
funny.
They were eventually cleared of wrongdoing in that investigation, but, again, this is a very image-conscious company, so how does that look? That the feds are investigating us because our animals keep dying.
Well, I mean, frankly, with some of the stories you're telling us, it's almost par for the course for this era, but whatever.
Disney also had problems with Go.com. it was basically a portal they'd bought for all of Disney's content and subsidiaries. You know, sort of a one-stop shop on the interwebs, which was still a novel thing at the time.
No, I remember this. ABC was even abc.go.com exactly. for yes. a while.
Because
it was a revolutionary idea at the time, I'm sure.
Well, it really wasn't, because consumers were already using search engines, and the company lost nearly $1 billion in 1998.
Ooh. Wrong again, John.
Oh, man.
Now, I think they didn't really complete the launch, based on my notes, until 1999, but even so, like you said, it's no longer abc.go.com.
Right, and in fact, that kind of goes to show how far they had gone off the reservation by that point.
Disney shows on TV were also performing erratically, and a lot of ABC's executives didn't take Eisner seriously, because they felt he was about 20 years out of date with what he was pitching.
What kind of stuff was ABC showing at the time?
I think Home Improvement had just been canceled around this time, although I always thought that was a Fox show for some reason. And if you'll remember, I think Ellen's show was on ABC, and it ended up getting canceled after she publicly came out, because this was back still when that was not a wise thing to do.
I vaguely remember it went on for either the rest of a season or a full season after she came out, but it... Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
do well. Was this also the era of like the Drew Carey show?
It was, I believe. Or I think, wasn't Drew Carey a little later?
I don't remember. I know it was on when I was in high school, so it's on at the time. I just don't know when the high water mark is.
Well, there was one big success that Disney had on TV at the time.
Full House?
In 1998, Bob Iger and Eisner previewed a game show that was to be developed for ABC. They love Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which I know I remember when that was like the thing that everybody was watching.
Oh, yeah. With Regis.
Yeah.
Apparently that's still on, like, daytime TV, but obviously it's not the thing that 30 million people are tuning in to watch.
Well, now that it's become commonplace to win $1 million, it's less interesting. When they went, like, 5 seasons without anybody winning, it was a big deal. Actually, if I remember right, the original series went until someone won, didn't they? And then they stopped it.
Yeah, and if I recall correctly, too, when he won, it was like news.
Yeah.
It was a big deal.
I remember that. I remember seeing the headlines the day after Who Wants to Be a Millionaire got its first millionaire.
Yeah, and he didn't need any lifeline. He just called his dad with the last one, because he knew the answer. I remember that very well.
I also remember seeing the Onion's article about it, about the Russia's most popular game show, Who Wants to Eat a Meal? I'm sorry, I still think that's funny. I know Nick doesn't agree.
That's fine.
That's because you're a horrible person.
Yeah, that's true.
But the biggest thing that could potentially ruin Disney's image at the time was Katzenberg's continued lawsuit against Disney.
Make him go away. That's how these things do.
They wanted to pay him, but they were disagreeing on the amount to pay him. And Katzenberg wasn't taking any shit. He had already showed that there had been some significant flops during his tenure there, including Newsies and Billy Bathgate.
I didn't know Newsies was a flop. I remember that movie. A
huge flop. Obviously, Disney eventually decided that they didn't want to have a huge trial, because this was right after OJ, so everybody was tuning in to high-publicity trials, and there would already be a huge amount of publicity towards a trial involving Disney executives. So eventually, they announced a partial settlement. Disney agreed to pay Katzenberg 72.5% of the 2% bonus he was owed. They agreed to a trial before a referee who would come up with a final actual number of what that 2% constituted. They also agreed to pay $117 million up front, and $40 million was to settle his claims to profits from the merchandise based on the films he oversaw.
That's a lot of money.
And again, at the time, Disney still... they had some flops, and even the movies they were producing that turned out to be hits, like Armageddon, were so expensive that they weren't helping the bottom line. That autobiography and business book that Tony Schwartz was writing was eventually published, but was ill-timed. It came right on the heels of the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and Disney was having its most serious problems in years. Also,
Was that because of the Monica Lewinsky problem?
No, it was because of all the publicity they were getting around... the trial with Katzenberg and what he was revealing and all that fun stuff. And
So it's not looking good for Eisner.
Katzenberg was also extensively mentioned in the book, even though Eisner had previously assured Katzenberg that there would be no reference to him. So, sounds as though everything's coming up Katzenberg, right? He had just signed on the dotted line to work with Steven Spielberg and David Geffen to launch DreamWorks. But DreamWorks got off to a very rough start. Small Soldiers, which is one of the first movies it produced, bombed in the U.S., and the first Steven Spielberg-directed film that DreamWorks distributed didn't do well either. It was Amistad, which I know we all have hold in the same regard as E.T. and Indiana Jones.
I saw that in, like, high school. It's the slave ship one, right? Yeah. Like, that's the Schindler's List-ish kind of bleak
movie. And I was probably being too cruel because I personally haven't seen it, but either way, when you think about Steven Spielberg movies, Amistad isn't what automatically comes up.
No, it's not a family film either.
It's the type of film you make to win Oscars.
Well, speaking of Oscar bait, the first big hit that DreamWorks had was Saving Private Ryan.
That's a good one.
But they had to share that with Paramount, so they didn't get all the money that it earned. And if you'll recall, Saving Private Ryan was going to be the thing that really catapulted DreamWorks to being a serious studio, and it would do that by sweeping the Oscars. And Steven Spielberg won Best Director that year, but it lost Best Picture to Shakespeare in Love, which was a Disney picture.
That's a stupid movie.
It's still one of the most controversial upsets ever at the Oscars. I've only seen Shakespeare in Love once. I don't know. I guess it was a good idea, but I don't know if I ever want to watch it again.
Yeah, it was meh.
No. Saving Private Ryan is a much better movie.
The Academy Awards is weird.
But, I mean, if I remember right, the trend holds up that movies that win Best Picture are rarely the movies people remember. Like, if you go back through the history of the Academy Awards, a lot of the Best Picture films, you'd be hard-pressed to say, oh, yeah, I know that. It's not really a common film. But the films they were up against are household names.
It really depends on the year, I think. I know last year, everybody has already forgotten about the two films that were going head-to-head against each other. When was the last time anybody watched La La Land?
Oh, no, they're watching, what is it, The Showman now? That piece of crap?
I don't know. I didn't see it. Another big thing that Katzenberg wanted to do was develop a movie based on the Ten Commandments.
That's never been done before. How clever of him.
A guy named Katzenberg wants a movie on the Ten Commandments? Okay,
not
sure.
Not just any movie based on the Ten Commandments, an animated remake of the movie The Ten Commandments.
Oh, shit. Did he do... oh, my God. What is this movie called?
The Prince of Egypt?
Prince of Egypt. Thank you very much.
The cartoon? Yes.
Oh, that was something. I remember that. I remember that well. That's funny. That might be a stay tuned, actually.
Katzenberg recruited artists he'd worked with at Disney, as well as Spielberg's Amblimation, to make the movie. He worked with biblical scholars and Muslim scholars to help write the film. And it really was a passion project for him, which, In the end, it became the highest-grossing non-Disney animated film in history, but wasn't the sort of Lion King success that Disney had enjoyed. Also,
take that, Don Bluth.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Also, there was a problem that the Prince of Egypt had that Disney ever had, which was merchandising. You can't exactly...
Merchandising.
You can't make an action figure out of the burning bush.
But you can out of Moses. South Park did it.
Pull the string and he goes, Pharaoh, let my people go.
Played by Ronald Reagan?
That was supposed to be Charlton Heston, but yeah, sure. Ronald Reagan too.
He's an adequate substitute.
Well, let my people go.
So what animated films was Disney making in this era? Well, let's take a look.
Okay.
First, in 1997, was Hercules.
Oh, yeah.
It was an unusual film as it was markedly different from the original Greek stories, which are not kid-friendly.
Not at all. The movie has nothing to do with Hercules.
No.
As a student of classical history, it pissed me off to no end.
The film underwent numerous revisions. It was originally going to be an animated version of The Odyssey, but that was abandoned because you can't make The Odyssey into a comedy.
They made Hercules into a comedy, so you could do anything, apparently.
At the time it was originally pitched, directors Ron Clements and John Musker were developing their dream project, which was Treasure Planet.
Oh, gross.
They directed Hercules and had agreed to years beforehand only because Katzenberg said, this was back when Katzenberg was at the company, that Disney would do Treasure Planet if they did Hercules first.
Okay.
You're not telling me that Katzenberg made good decisions.
Well, the directors wanted to make a more satiric film that poked fun at celebrity culture, which wasn't something Disney did.
Through Treasure Planet or through Hercules?
Which they, I guess, but to be fair, this will go off maybe somewhere else, but California Adventure, when it opened, had a ride that was nothing but poking fun at celebrity culture. So
I feel like Disney is the wrong venue to take to do that.
You're not wrong. That doesn't mean they tried. Or didn't try, rather.
Yeah, I don't think they tried too hard. I did like the jazzy style about it, and they had like the Greek chorus was the jazz backup singers. That was an interesting twist, but
it was
just silly. And who was the nymph? It was
Rosie Perez.
No, the teacher guy.
Oh.
Danny DeVito.
Yeah.
Danny DeVito.
Yeah.
Oh.
The songs in Hercules had been based on what was popular on MTV throughout the 90s. The muses were based on the music video for En Vogue's "Free Your Mind."
That's funny.
Disney also got a celebrity voice cast together, including Rip Torn as Zeus, Danny DeVito, and Charlton Heston as the narrator at the beginning. But
there's a narrator?
Yeah, there is. That gets interrupted by the muses, if you remember.
I do not. I've seen that movie only a few times because I hate it so much.
Well, at the time, Charlton Heston was pretty much only doing voiceover. Like, he was the narrator at the beginning of Armageddon. He did this.
You mean Tim Burton hadn't convinced him to be an ape in the new Planet of the Apes
yet? And Michael Moore convinced him to let him on his property?
And I bet you he doesn't regret any of these decisions. Actually, of those, Michael Moore might be the one he regrets the least.
Oh, God. Yeah, I'm looking this up. James Woods was the voice of Hades.
Oh, we're about to get into that because of...
He's okay, but Bobcat Goldthwait was one of the demons.
Yes, he was.
Wow.
Well...
That's an annoying voice.
Speaking of James Woods, he's always said that he considers Hades the best role he's ever had.
James
he's
Woods?
Yeah. In it.
Yep.
Really? Okay, whatever.
And the directors really lucked out because they had wanted the perfect person cast to be Hades, and that was Jack Nicholson. But
sure.
Jack Nicholson wanted a Jack Nicholson paycheck, and Eisner said no.
So he instead did what? Analyze This? Or As Good As It Gets? What year is this?
It was released in 97, so yeah, he was doing As Good As It Gets at the same time, I guess. Because
that was
better. The same year, and he won an Oscar for it, so...
I was going to say, yeah. That was As Good As It Got.
So because they couldn't get Jack Nicholson to be Hades, they went on to their second choice, whom they considered a person that could bring a more comedic tone to it.
Wes Studi.
John Lithgow.
Sorry. That's even worse than Wes Studi.
But they eventually decided he wasn't appropriate, so then they went on to James Woods.
Yeah.
And critics praised James Woods as Hades, and... Woods has said that he based his portrayal of the character on Katzenberg.
That's a dubious honor.
The film got a good response critically, but not great, and it still has an 83% on Rotten Tomatoes.
That's an interesting one, because as we're recording it, the Netflix deal with Disney still exists, but not for long, if I recall the deal. But, I watched it not that long ago, and I got about half an hour in, and I was like, not thinking it was necessarily bad. I was just thinking it was kind of, you know, meh. And that's kind of where it sits in my memory, right? Just kind of nothing. So I don't know. I
file it under the same thing as, like, Pocahontas. Like, it exists, but I will not go out of my way to watch it.
That's fair. I mean, that's literally probably where it should fall in my mind. Its biggest sin to me, other than, like you said, kind of the gospel singer Greek chorus, it's completely forgettable. Like, there's nothing to it. It's one of those ones where the villain, and you can say he's doing Katzenberg all he wants. He sounds like a bemoled Jewish comedian from the 90s. You know, it's like, oh, and this guy. Yeah.
One interesting note about the production, the character designs for the movie were done by a guy named Gerald Scarfe. Mm-hmm. I know I sound like I'm introducing Troy McClure. You may remember him for designing the animations for Pink Floyd's The Wall movie as well.
No kidding.
So he did the design for this movie?
He designed the characters.
Okay. Interesting. So was he responsible for the angular design of, like, the people and stuff like
exactly.
that?
Exactly.
Okay. I guess it works for whatever they were doing.
Well, I just...
Literally, for whatever.
Well, I just wonder who at Disney's heard the album The Wall and then saw the cartoons in the movie and decided we need this man to work for us, because those are some pretty screwed up cartoons.
Really, given what we've covered on this show, does it really surprise you?
There's...
Messed up people working for Disney and making some messed up films.
So Disney's next big animated feature was Mulan, which was actually a milestone for them. It was the first independent film of Disney's Florida Animation Studios. They didn't want Mulan looking like a Disney princess, so the animators took great care to emulate Chinese art. Which, I know on... Myopia, we watched that, and I think a couple of us mentioned how it looked like art from that time period, which I think was a good touch.
Yeah, and I'm sure it doesn't help, or it doesn't hurt that this may mollify the Chinese after that whole Dalai Lama thing.
Originally, it was based on a movie Disney was making called China Doll, about a Chinese woman who falls in love with a British soldier, but nobody liked that character.
Or the idea, or the concept, or the racism. Right. Or...
Ming-Na voiced the main character. She was most famous at the time for the Joy Luck Club, and since then, I think she's still on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., if I remember correctly.
I will take all your right. word for that.
Also, and I just found this hilarious, Pat Morita voices the Chinese Emperor, and Morita is Japanese, just as an FYI.
That's funny.
Well, it goes under, like, Hollywood just files them under Asian.
At least it wasn't someone who was filed originally under Jewish, and they were like, you're different.
Yeah.
I mean, because, like, Leonard Nimoy used to be Native Americans in, like, old Westerns, if I recall correctly, too, so, you know.
Oh. Ming-Na was Chun-Li in the Street Fighter movie. Oh, jeez.
I guess that one under... That means you can file that movie under ethnically sensitive.
Totally. Gugh.
Gugh is right.
Oh, man. Well, also, if you'll recall, the little creature in that movie was the dragon Mushu that Eddie Murphy voiced. And yep. That was actually a...
Anything says ancient Chinese dragon like Eddie Murphy.
It was a creation of Roy Disney. He created that character.
Uh-huh.
And...
I expect Roy.
Yeah, so do I. A guy like Roy should know better.
The final movie that Disney released during this time was Tarzan. Yeah. It was directed by Kevin Lima, the same guy who directed A Goofy Movie.
I like A Goofy Movie.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
I've heard you singing the soundtrack, Nick, many times.
Yeah, well, that's not on tape yet, so maybe that'll be next. As we're recording, the Addams Family just came out with us singing the end credits, so...
Lima originally was reluctant to do it. Katzenberg, back when it was in development while he was still at the studio, wanted to make the film at a Canadian-based animation studio. After Katzenberg quit, Eisner contacted Lima again about the project. He didn't want to make the movie a musical, as he thought the image of Tarzan singing would be ridiculous.
As opposed to just the general image of Tarzan in general.
I mean, Tarzan's a wonderful Americana creation, man. I mean, there's a town in California named after him.
The white man civilizing the monkeys.
Yeah, right. Also, it's a great metaphor for repressed homosexual urges, but, you know, whatever.
I don't think we quite covered that on the myopia episode of Tarzan.
Nah, we were pretty drunk.
Now, you probably remember the voice cast that was in it. There was, what's his name? Bishop from Aliens. Was the Silverback. Rosie O'Donnell somehow got on that movie. And, of course, Wayne Knight was Tantor the Elephant. One piece of trivia I found was that Wayne Knight was a replacement. The person they originally went to be Tantor was Woody Allen. Yes. Woody Allen.
Because they thought it was funny to have an elephant with such a soft, delicate, lilting, kind of nebbishy voice, well, isn't it? It's like, well, I mean, it's the ant from Ants, which I don't know if that had come out yet.
That's actually why he didn't get the role, because Ants was a DreamWorks project that came out first. So Woody Allen was busy doing that, and they didn't, you know.
I only do so much acting a year. I just don't know how I could do it. Asian women around.
That makes a lot of sense, that because the elephant guy, as a kid, he was a very, if I remember right, he was a very almost hypochondriac. Like, he was afraid of everything. And I could easily see Woody Allen playing that character.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Tarzan was eventually released in 1999, and it was Disney's second highest opening weekend ever.
Did it fall Phil like Collins a stone or something?
No, it did very well at the box office, and it still has an 88% on Rotten Tomatoes, and the only thing that ever beat it in the opening weekend at that time for its animated films was The Lion King.
Interesting.
So, yeah, I mean, we covered some of those on Myopia, but when I was looking through it, I'm like going, oh, okay, so, like, Hercules was just so people could make Treasure Planet. That's the only reason that movie exists.
And Treasure Planet is a disaster.
A colossal failure, but we'll get into that later.
Tarzan is 88 minutes long.
I counted as 84 minutes long because I was fast forward through Rosie O'Donnell scatting.
Oh, God, oh,
that's
yes.
That's right. I remember that.
I did it during the last watch. It's like, I have better things to do with my life than watching that.
Don't we all?
Yeah.
Also, Minnie Driver was in the movie, as was... okay, that's pretty much it for celebrities.
Glenn Close, she was someone
Minnie
in
Driver,
it.
She was Jane.
No,
oh,
Glenn Close.
Was, yeah, the adopted mother.
Yeah, that's it, okay.
Who's on screen for...
So who is Tarzan? What's he been in? Tony Goldwyn.
Brian Blessed provided the Tarzan yell, which is great.
Nice.
Tony Goldwyn was in Ghost as, I think, the villain. I've never seen Ghost. He's in Scandal as the president. He's done some stuff.
Some stuff? Yeah.
He was in The Last Samurai, which was a movie that exists.
It does exist.
Hey, you're right.
The white man civilizing others.
Yes, because obviously that's the only samurai movie that needs to exist because there's a white dude in it.
That's so funny because I saw that when it first came out and found it kind of good, and I don't think I've watched it, but like... Once since? It's, what, 20 years old now?
It's getting there. I think this year is its 15th anniversary.
Wow.
Disney, despite that success with Tarzan, was still having its reputation tattered. There was a lot of corporate infighting, a lot of fighting between its old executives. Eisner wasn't letting people explore the way they had in the past. And also, during this time, I think it was 1997, Disney's board of directors was voted the worst board of directors in America.
By
Playboy.
By Business Week magazine. So Disney was in a lot of trouble, and the magic of its image was starting to fade. DreamWorks was out and was releasing films. Even though DreamWorks wasn't as successful as Disney had been at this point, there was no reason to believe that wouldn't change. So what was Eisner to do during this period? Well,
drink heavily.
Vacation, all I ever wanted. Vacation had to get away.
We will get into Eisner's decline and his eventual ouster from Disney next time. Ooh. I just love ending you guys on cliffhangers. So, let's go around the horn real quick. What do we have to plug, starting with you, Nick?
Well, the main podcast is My Opie Defending Childhood. It is, you know, kind of movies you grew up with. As Daniel referred to earlier, we've done a good amount of these movies in actuality. And so it's kind of interesting to hear the backgrounds behind them, because when we're drinking and we're talking about them, we don't usually think about lives that are at stake. So, you know, that's kind of an interesting aspect to all of this. Also, if you're in the Atlanta area, I'm in a comedy group called Citiprov. And the first Thursday of every month in general, we do something. But go to Citiprov.com to see when our current schedule is, because we have been shuffling that around. And then finally, I do a podcast called Dune Repeat, which is history-based. And it should be coming back next month. And when I say that, it could literally be any next month, but you don't know that. That's it.
Are you sure that's it? I'm pretty sure you have another 5 minutes of content to add.
Oh, well, sure. I'm currently applying for jobs, so if you know.
And I'm the showrunner for Mission Briefing, the James Bond podcast, also on the Myopia Network. Anything and everything James Bond. We've run out of movies, so we have to get a little creative. But, yeah, we've been going strong for a couple months now after we finished the movies, so... Yeah, good stuff coming.
All right, well, thanks very much, guys. Thank you for joining me, and thank you all out there for listening. See you next time.
Hey, everyone. I've been asked to unpack my recording gear and re-record the credits one last time before moving. Myopia Defender Childhood is brought to you by the ESO Network. It is produced and assembled by Dude Letter Podcasting. Your host is Nick Hoffman. Your editors are Ann Burns and Daniel Suttis. The creative team behind all this is Matt Quinn, Daniel Suttis, and Nick Hoffman. The theme song is Surf Shimmy by Kevin MacLeod. You can find his music in comptech.com. Everything we do for you guys. So rate, review, find us on iTunes, Facebook, Twitter, Letterboxd, and send us reviews, because it's the best. It makes my day every time I see a new one, a new fan, and we get you guys all the time. So help me overwhelm this sense of dread dealing with mortgages and such. And finally, we do this for you. So stay tuned next week and every future week when we put a piece of your past on trial. Thanks, guys.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the Tee Public Store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.